NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to explore the newly announced 2009-2010 season. Tickets are on sale Thursday, July 16th at 10 a.m. More information is available online at krannertcenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. So please, you could be with us today. Our guest this afternoon is a man who loves words and language and who has read the Oxford English Dictionary, all of it, all 20 volumes. He says it is the greatest story he has ever read. Amon Shea tells the tale of this undertaking in his book, Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 pages. Amon Shea describes himself as a collector of words. He says dictionaries, including the OED, are the tools with which he does his collecting. As a hobby, he says it's largely useless. He says it will not help you in the workplace, and you run the risk of boring your friends. But I ask, where would we be without words? Here within Amon Shea's book, Reading the OED, you'll find some wonderful words. In addition to the words, there are thoughtful essays on words, one for each letter in the alphabet. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Amon Shea is also the author of Depraved English and co-author of Insulting English. His book, Reading the OED, is now out in paperback from Perigee, a division of Penguin. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Amon Shea, welcome.
Hi.
How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, you found the OED to be the greatest story ever told in English. How so?
I'm always kind of surprised when people frequently say to me, oh, I love reading through the dictionary, but nobody ever says that they like to sit down and read it from cover to cover. I think that's kind of the logical progression. If you enjoy reading the dictionary, you might as well read it as a book. I think that everything that you would find in a great book, you do find in a great dictionary. It just happens to be somewhat out of order, but they're really all the same words that are there, and the words themselves have wonderful, wonderful stories to them.
When you set out to read this dictionary, did you expect that that's what you'd find?
I did in a way, I guess, because it's not the first dictionary that I've read. I've been in this habit, you could say this unhealthy habit, perhaps, of reading dictionaries for the past 12 years or so. And one of the things that it's so delightful about reading dictionaries, and I suppose almost any kind of reference work, is that they're all telling the same story, but they all tell it differently. But they're really telling the story of our language. They're telling the story of our vocabulary, and it's a great story. And it's this common myth, I think, that many people fall prey to, which is that all dictionaries are the same. That's why you frequently hear people say, look it up in the dictionary, though there was only one. You rarely hear people say, look it up in a dictionary, which is really surprising. It's almost like saying, go to the store to buy anything, even without differentiating between. There are different stores. There are different dictionaries, and no two dictionaries are ever identical. But I had read previous dictionaries, a number of Webster's and a number of other ones, and so I knew that for me, it's a really intoxicating wonderful experience.
Yeah. Here in the studio with me, I have two dictionaries. The one to my right is terrible. It's awful. I'd like to throw it away, but it doesn't belong to me.
can you say what dictionary it is?
It's the New Concise Webster's Dictionary. It's pretty awful. It's pretty old, too. It costs $3.50.
Well, one of the things that's funny about the phrase Webster's Dictionary is that it very often does not mean what people think that it means, which is that the name Webster entered the public domain, I think, back in 1876 or something. And so everybody started printing Webster's Dictionaries. And it just means dictionary. And for a brief period of time, I used to collect what I call the fake Webster's. And my favorite one that I have is from the 1930s, and it was Standard Oil printed a Webster's Dictionary, and they handed it out at gas stations for free. And Standard Oil Webster's Dictionary. Absolutely god-awful dictionary. It's really terrible. But it's just wonderful that Standard Oil briefly got into the field of lexicography.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem with this dictionary that I don't care for at all is its conciseness. If you need to look up a word, you're not going to find it in here.
Right.
You know, it's just, this is all the stuff you should know, pretty much.
Well, what's the other one that you have?
The other one is not too bad at all. It comes from my desk. It's the Random House Webster's.
Oh, column. Yeah, Random House has a great dictionary.
Yeah, yeah. Updated annually. Mm-hmm. The right word every time. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Amin Shay. He is the author of Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 Pages. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Did you anticipate the headaches?
To a certain extent, because, as I said, it's been part of the reading experience previously. And I think that, to a certain extent, headaches are inevitable when you're reading that kind of type. It's fairly dense, and especially with something like the OED, they change typefaces regularly depending on what they're writing, whether the etymologies are in a different font and the definitions, which are in a different font and type size from the headwords and the quotations. So that can really take a little strain on the eyes, which easily produces headaches. But there's nothing wrong with occasional headaches. I mean, I didn't have migraines. I could still function. And so, as I think I mentioned in the book, I just intentionally chose to view the headache as a sign of progress, because the more I read, the worse my head hurt. And so if I had a really kind of blossoming headache by the afternoon, I know that I had really read a considerable amount of text.
So what was a day like in your life when you were when you had embarked on this project?
It would start with a considerable quantity of coffee, and coffee was more or less a constant throughout. I mean, in certain respects, I consider this year that I took off to read the dictionary in part just an excuse to read, and in part it was also just an excuse to sit around drinking coffee with bread. You know, people seem to frequently think that this was some kind of chore, trial, but it really was not. The way that I really like to think about it is, and this is true, is that if you imagine your favorite book and think about how delightful it would be if your favorite book would take you an entire year to read. It's you know, we're all familiar with that feeling. It's what I call the feeling of incipient sadness, when you realize that you're on the last 20 or 30 pages of the book and you're proceeding along this inexorable path to the finish. And you can always come back and read the book again, and that's great. I've read many books numerous times, but it's never the same as the first time around. And if the book you're reading is 20-odd thousand pages long, that feeling of incipient sadness is considerably delayed. So every day I would get up and make several strong cups of coffee, and then I would go to the library of a library basement of a college library not too far from me, and sit there at a desk and read. And that was ideal because there were no windows in the basement and there are very few students at this particular library. And so you're really just alone with your book, or I was. And you can really get lost in the book. And that was my general day. I would sit there for maybe 10 or 11 hours, I suppose, a day and just read.
Did you dream of words?
I did, unfortunately. that was a little bit spooky. Every once in a while, I would wake up and just hear some disembodied voice saying some particular word, which never seemed to be terribly prophetic or important or anything like that. I would just have words that would get stuck in my head sometimes, and they were never useful words.
Hmm. I hope that during the course of the interview that you'll share some of your favorite words with us and their meanings. Maybe you'd share with one with us now.
Sure. Well, one of the words that has always been nearest and dearest to my heart is words such as apricity, which is it really is everything that I love in a word, which is, first of all, it's useless, and second of all, it's beautiful. And apricity describes the definition is the warmth of the sun in the wintertime.
Mm.
And everybody, when they hear that word, has a similar reaction. They think, and I think immediately, I imagine, this is what happened to me, I think about what that feeling is like. It draws forth perhaps a memory. It draws forth some kind of sentiment. It draws forth something intangible from the person who is experiencing this word for the first time. And that's what's so delightful about it, is that it's not a useful word in terms of you can go out with your friends and start talking about the apricity. You know, at best, somebody will maybe poke you in the eye if you start doing that. There's nothing wrong with them doing that. But then when you feel the warmth of the sun in the wintertime, you might think there's a word for that. You might not remember it, but you might. My experience is that I would notice that more, knowing how to name something and knowing that there was a term that existed for some phenomena, I would pay more attention to that thing. Similarly, the word petrichor describes the smell that comes off of the ground when it first begins to rain. And it's that beautiful, kind of almost pungent, loamy smell that rises off the concrete when it first begins, especially if it hasn't rained for a while, you know, in the winter, in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everybody knows that smell. And again, they hear that word for the first time, and you can tell that they're just thinking about what that is like, what that smells. So it's these words are so evocative. They don't need to be useful. They're beautiful in and of themselves.
Yeah. I like the word advesperate.
to creep into dusk. Yeah, well, it's just also, that's just such a beautiful sounding word to turn into the evening, to turn into night. Any word that has vesper somewhere in it, I think, is just delightful.
It evokes evening prayer and song.
Yeah, it does. There's this wonderful term that I think Eliot had. and I can't even remember what the term was now. It was the term he coined for things like Proust's Madeleines, you know, things that that draw forth a memory. And it can just be a word. It can be a pastry. It can be something. It can be a sound. But that's what these words are for me. They're something that draws forth memories or emotions or feelings. Mm-hmm. So they go above and beyond communication in a conversational or colloquial sense.
Yeah. Speaking of pastry, I like the word artolitor. Now, that doesn't have to do with pastry, but bread.
Yeah. Artolitor is somebody who loves bread, a big fan of bread. And I myself am an enormous fan of bread. There are a lot of bread words in the OED, which is something I always thought was kind of funny. You really notice some of the peculiarities. I don't know if it's peculiarities of the speakers of the language, but you certainly notice the oddities of the language when you read all the way through a dictionary.
Mm. Another word that I enjoyed finding, foibles.
Yeah, a minor foible. Foibles is such a kind of distinctive. I'm sorry, that's totally wrong. Foibles is a minor foible. It's a weakness or something.
Yeah.
It's so kind of specific. It addresses the kind of grayness, you know. It's a distinctive weakness or a weakness for something in particular. And it ties in nicely with foible. But this is something it's so delightful about kind of reading through all these definitions is you see how many kind of shades of meaning there can be to things. It reminds me of this word avigilus, which describes slightly greedy or moderately greedy or somewhat greedy. And it's so pleasing to me that we don't have to say somebody is either greedy or not greedy. There's a word in between those two things. And I think of it as kind of acceptably greedy.
And how do you spell that?
Avidulous.
Avidulous. Somewhat greedy. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, word collector Amon Shay, author of Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 pages. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, stories about words. Give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800 1-800-222-9455. Well, speaking, going back to the idea of picking up a book first time around, you read your first dictionary some 10 or 11 years ago. What inspired you?
As many people have said, or as I've heard many people say, it's enjoyable just to kind of leaf through a dictionary, and it's almost certain that if you do so, you're going to find something that you don't know. And that's enchanting. I cannot think of too many books of which I can say I've never come away from reading it feeling stupider. I can't think of too many things about which I can say that. And yet every time I ever picked up a dictionary, I learned something, and it may have only been for the short term, and I may have quickly forgotten it. But I always came away with some additional nugget of knowledge or something. And I would find these delightful words in the dictionary, and I found that although this was, again, enchanting, I would also then be plagued by this feeling that if I'm finding these words, these wonderful words on this page, I must be missing other words on the other pages. And I think quite logically, other people might say quite maniacally, but I think quite logically decided that the only way in which I could be certain that I had not missed any of these great words is if I just read it straight through. And the thing that I find peculiar but delightful about reading a dictionary is that, you know, it's like they say about the phone book, you know, it's a great cast of characters but not much plot. But there is a sort of plot. It's almost disingenuous to say that there is almost a sort of plot to the dictionary. There is. It's not a discernible plot as we typically think of it. You know, there's no denouement, there's no catastrophe, there's no tidy wrap-up, but there are specific sections that are influenced by certain prefixes. In the case of the OED, it was written by a number of people. There were a number of editors for different letters, and so that particular dictionary took so long to write and has been such a work in progress that different sections will bear the influence of the editor who's working on them. So you notice these changes throughout the dictionary based on what language the words in question have been taken from, based on who edited it, based on when the particular part of the dictionary was written. So there are shifts and changes within it. They're just, again, they're not discernible plot as we typically think of it. But it does have an arc, a narrative arc of sorts.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana waiting for us on line one. Hi.
Hi. This is a delightful idea. I enjoy dictionaries very much, and when I open them to look up a word, it usually takes me 10 minutes before I close it because I'm browsing, but it never occurred to me to read one. I also have several that I use at different times. I'm curious, when you were reading the dictionary, did you take extensive notes to remember all of these words that became favorites, or at the end of the day, did you just remember a dozen?
That's a great question. I did take extensive notes, and I did so as I was reading. I know from unfortunate prior experience that if you just think to yourself, oh, I'll remember that word and I'll come back to it tomorrow, it never works out that way. When I was reading the OED, I had a large kind of ledger from the from the 19th century that I found that was totally blank and maybe 500 pages long, these great big beautiful old sheets of paper. And anytime I came across any word that I thought maybe I want to come back to that, I wrote it down. And I would guess that I probably wrote down 10,000 words or so throughout the course of reading it. And so sometimes I can just sit down with that notebook and go back and kind of revisit my favorite parts of the dictionary now.
And when you were reading it, did you know that you would write a book about reading?
I did. I managed to get my publisher to agree to purchase the book, and that was how I was able to take a year off in order to do more or less nothing else.
Okay. Well, what a fascinating project, and I'm going to the library to look up your book.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited for our guest, Amon Shea, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Did writing this book, reading the OED, help you digest the experience?
Did it help me digest the experience?
Yeah.
I suppose in a way, although I was writing it as I went along. It was not so much a case where I just, sat down and read the dictionary and then kind of remembered everything that had happened and wrote a book about it. It was more just as I was reading through the dictionary, I would write down the thoughts that I had. And I guess the thoughts I had that are encapsulated in the book are not purely about the dictionary or the experience of reading the dictionary. It's also composed of my thoughts about reading and my, my feelings and sentiments and memories of reading. I've been an avid reader my whole life. And that is, for me, one of the reasons why I find reading dictionaries so captivating, is that it's you can always come back and read it again. There's always something to read. And if you allow yourself to really become open to this kind of magic that's in these seemingly stolid reference works, you'll never be at a loss for something to read, which is really an attractive notion.
Hmm. I don't know which letter, which essay that corresponds with which essay, but you tell readers about a friend of yours by the name of Madeline. Tell us about her.
Madeline is a wonderful, wonderful character and a great friend. She is she has what I think is the world's foremost collection of dictionaries. She's been collecting them for, 40 years or so now. Madeline is the kind of example I use when I mentioned that when people think that I'm odd because I have maybe 1,000 volumes of dictionaries and word books, and people express trepidation or hesitation when they find that out, I point out that my friend Madeline has somewhere between 20 and 30,000. And she's just, she has this beautiful collection of dictionaries. And for a number of years, she made her living just purely by buying and selling dictionaries. She was the only bookseller, I believe, in the world who did that. And so she's more or less an independent scholar with the museum's worth of this of reference works in her house. And I have bought a large part of the dictionary collection that I own. I've bought from her. But she's just somebody who is similarly to me in love with these books of words.
Yeah. Is it a big group of people?
No, there are not too many of us, but we do exist. I do know a number of other people, most of whom seem to work in lexicography, who do collect dictionaries. The English dictionary itself is relatively new. It did not start with Samuel Johnson, as many people think, but it started at the very beginning of the 17th century. The first English dictionary was in 1604, and it was a tiny little book. Maybe had 2,500 words that were defined, called a table alphabetical by a fellow named Robert Cawdrey. But since then, there have been thousands and thousands of dictionaries published. And again, they're all different in some way or another, or in many, many ways from each other. Which is one of the things that makes them so attractive, I think, to collect, is that each one is changing as time goes on.
Yeah. Robert Cawdrey's dictionary was called A Table Alphabetical. What was it like? You said it was small.
2,500 words. I don't remember how many pages it was, maybe 60 or 70. Most of the early English dictionaries, or what we call English, there were English Latin dictionaries before that, or English French dictionaries before that, but he wrote the first English to English dictionary. And both his dictionary and most of the ones that followed for the next 100 years or so were what were called hard word dictionaries, which is that they weren't really concerned with defining words that they assumed that everybody knew. They were called hard word dictionaries. And so they were designed to help people who wanted to know what these fancy new words that were springing up in English were.
kind of strange, like a word like axokakalogical, which is great big fancy words, which means being composed of both good and bad qualities. And so if you look through these early English dictionaries, after 100 years or so, people started to kind of define the simple words, but almost in an amusing way. There was one of my favorites is a dictionary from the early 18th century, and they defined cow as a beast well known. And so they're kind of willing to define common words, but they're almost saying, like, come on, everybody knows what a cow is. We don't really need to explain it to you. And it wasn't until some time later that lexicographers and dictionaries started actually trying to really explain all the simple common words. And that's, I think it's an interesting development in lexicography. One of the things that people also think about dictionaries is that, you know, if they have, you know, a lot of big words, that they're a great dictionary. If they have a lot of uncommon words, they're a great dictionary. And to me, the real value of a dictionary and the hardest part of putting it together is how they define the little words. Because big words are relatively easy to define. I mean, like that word I just mentioned, agathocacological, it really only means one thing. Being composed of both good and bad qualities, but and if you ever want to give yourself a real headache, try to define the word the. It's astoundingly difficult to try to think of all the things that the word put means or set. Set's a great example. In the original OED, it took them 60,000 words to define set. It's unbelievably hard to think of all the possible things that set could mean. It's got hundreds and hundreds of meanings to it. And that's where the real work in these dictionaries is differentiating between all these kind of incredibly delicate shades of meaning that you find in these common words.
Yeah. You say the editor who perhaps is most apparent in terms of his presence within the pages of the OED is James Murphy. Who was he, and how did he make his mark?
James Murray was the first editor of the OED, and he was this wonderful, largely autodidactic scholar. He was a Scotsman who was the editor-in-chief of the OED from its kind of beginning until his death in the early 20th century. And the OED just took so much longer than anybody ever thought. The first edition took, I think, 44 years. The first part of it, they released it in little bits, and it was first released in the first volume in 1884, and the first edition was finished in 1928. And because it took so long, they kept on adding additional editors to help James Murray with the work. And he was, again, he was largely self-taught, but he spoke enormous number of languages. And he just had this very, very firm belief as to what this dictionary should do. And the OED is so much different from many dictionaries in that it is kind of uncompromising in a way that you would almost, it'd be very difficult to imagine a major publisher doing today. The reason it's so large, for instance, is because there are 2.5 million quotations that they put into the dictionary to illustrate how these words are used. And a lot of that was due to James Murray. He had this idea, this vision that he was following of this is what a proper and really, you know, well-done dictionary will do. It will illustrate how the language is used. And he was not the one who came up with this idea, but he was the one who really executed it more than anybody else. And he just, he worked on this dictionary, I don't know, 70, 80, 90 hours a week for decades, the last several decades of his life. And Simon Winchester wrote a wonderful book called The Professor and the Madman, which was in part about the making of the Oxford English Dictionary. And James Murray is the titular professor of the book, and the madman was a man named William Miner, who was locked away in a lunatic asylum, but contributed a large amount of work to the OED from his asylum.
And you can find, listeners, by the way, you can find an interview with Simon Winchester about this book at our website, will.illinois.edu. Simon Winchester was David Inge's guest on Focus 580, our morning call-in talk program. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Amon Shea, our guest today. He's the author, most recently, of Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 pages. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, what is it, can you sum up here, because we've been talking around this issue now since we began, what is it that makes the OED special? Can you summarize it for us?
Okay. Well, it's that it's a historical dictionary. Most dictionaries, if you look at them, they tell you what the word means now as it's used. And the OED will tell you, and sometimes if they're a big dictionary, if they're, you know, something like the Random House Unabridged or the Merriam-Webster Unabridged, they'll provide some citations of how it's used today. And one of the differences between those dictionaries and the OED is the OED would tell you how the word is used today and how it was used 100 years ago and how it was used 300 years ago and if it was still around, how it was used 500 years ago and 1,000 years ago. It really traces all the meanings of these words and all the words that were used from about 800 AD to the present, the last 1,200 years. And the way that they illustrate the words, they give definitions and etymologies, and that's all beautifully done. But as I said, the real meat of the book is that there is approximately 2.5 million, closing in on 3 million citations that they've drawn from literature and newspapers, mostly literature, throughout these past 1,200 years. And they use these citations, these quotations, to exhibit how these words actually are used. And it makes such a difference in understanding you know, how the vocabulary comes into play. And one of my favorite examples is a word, quomodo conchising, which means to make money in any way possible. And, you know, you see that word in the define, you think, oh, that's an interesting word, it's a nice word. You know, maybe I'll remember that word, I'll tuck it in my pocket and try to remember it later. But then they also provide this citation, and it's a wonderful quote from Sir Thomas Urquhart, and it's those Quomodo conchais and cluster fists and rapacious varlets. And suddenly the word kind of comes alive when you see it used. It assumes a personality, and it assumes a kind of depth that it doesn't have when it's just purely defined as this is what the word means. It gives you a real understanding of this word that's very difficult to get purely through a definition. And so when you read through the OED, if you just look through it, there are, for instance, I think 33,000 citations from Shakespeare. So, you know, you're getting an enormous chunk of Shakespeare's works is in the dictionary. It's just been kind of chopped up and thrown in some sort of madcap blender and then spat out into the page and spread out among 22,000 pages. But this is the real body of English literature is in the words and how they're used. You know, these words don't exist in a vacuum in the OED. They exist in almost in real life in terms of this is how these words were used and this is the way in which they take on meaning. So that's the biggest thing that really differentiates the OED from other dictionaries and what gives it such an enormous size.
Mm. Are there dictionaries in other languages that are akin to the OED?
Yeah, there are. I think there's a dictionary of Dutch that's closing in on 40-something volumes now. There is a dictionary of the Scottish tongue from 1800 onwards, and then there's a dictionary of the older Scottish tongue, which is up to 1800, and between the two of those, there are about 22 volumes. There are a number of other languages or national dictionaries that have taken on projects like this. The OED is, I think, the first one that was really completed. And it's one of the greatest examples of the art of historical lexicography. But there are other examples of this going on.
I would imagine the French have one.
There are French dictionaries like this, but then there is also that curious the French Academy, I think, has this kind of curious notion of words which should be in French and words which should not be in French, which is that kind of notion of should and should not be in is I believe, rather anathema to the editors of the OED. Most lexicographers, and there's an interesting kind of schism between people who write dictionaries and the people who use them, and it is that many times, and perhaps some of the callers will take this position, people say, well, this word should not be in the dictionary, or this is not a word. You often hear people say that's not a real word. It comes up, for instance, with a word like irregardless, or ain't. People often say that's not a real English word or something. And you very rarely find a dictionary maker who takes that position. They generally will say that their role is not to decide whether something is or is not a word. They just see if people use it. And if people use it, they record that usage. And I believe to lexicographers, it's almost, you know, for them to say that's not a word, so we will not put it in the dictionary. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a biologist saying that is not a cell. You know, I refuse to acknowledge that life form. It either exists or it doesn't. And if there's the evidence to support, you know, that people use this word, then they will record that usage.
Mm. Language pickmotes.
Right, somebody who finds a pickmote, isn't it? Somebody who finds trivial faults, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I like that one. That one can slide right into our vocabulary, I think.
Yeah.
A pickmote. I'm being a pickmote. I'm sorry, but...
It also reminds me of one of my other favorite words, which is so beautifully evocative, which is a Bayard. Bayard, like many words, has a variety of meanings, but my own personal favorite has always been that it's someone who's blind with the self-confidence of the ignorant.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Amin Shay, he is the author of Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 pages. Listeners, if you've got a question about words, you got a comment, a story to tell about words, give us a call. Join in, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. In the essay that comes before the words you've selected, beginning with the letter B, you say this. At the outset, you found B wildly entertaining. Why?
B, I don't have a real clear idea on why I found it so entertaining. I think it just had a really good, solid mix of Anglo-Saxon words and Latin roots as well. And it also, perhaps more than anything else, it had all these these prefixes of BE, some of which were like be missionary, which is to pester somebody with missionaries, or, you know, be dinner, which means to treat someone to dinner. It was such a kind of entertaining way of prefixing a word with the BE that added largely to it. But I think it was also just that I there was the stage at which, having read one full letter, I began to really become intoxicated with the experience of reading this dictionary.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. Nice to listen to all of this. Very interesting. When I was first teaching fifth and sixth graders in the early 70s, one of the dads who had a youngster in my room came in and noticed we were using an unabridged dictionary and that, of course, it was getting fairly hard use in a classroom setting. He wondered if he could supply us with a new unabridged dictionary, but he said that Second International is the last prescriptive dictionary, and I would be happy to put it in a safer place and provide you with a different one. And I wondered at the time, I had no idea what that even meant, the last prescriptive, and I've since learned about that. But maybe you would talk a little bit about that, and I'm just going to hang up and listen. This is fascinating.
Okay, great. The dictionary the caller is referring to is Webster's Second New International Dictionary, which was published in 1934. And there was a big hullabaloo in 1961 when the Merriam-Webster Company published the sequel, which was Webster's Third New International Dictionary. And there was a widespread feeling that the Webster's Third was unduly permissive, and that they were abdicating their role as guardians of the language. And the terms here, prescriptive, mean that the dictionary tells you how the language should be used, and descriptive means we just describe the language as it is used. And a great number of people thought that the new Webster's, Webster's Third, was, like I said, just kind of giving in to the decline of language, and that they were printing these horrible words like ain't and irregardless. It was largely a myth, I have to say. Webster's Second was not really any more prescriptive than Webster's Third. In fact, almost all the words that people, like the New York Times, was really against Webster's Third, to the extent that they actually printed an editorial saying, we refuse to acknowledge this new dictionary. We are going to continue using this older dictionary in our newsroom. And most of the words that they had problems with in Webster's Third already existed in Webster's Second. So not nearly. There were a number of changes that were made in Webster's Third, but there were things which were maybe hard to understand. For instance, they stopped using the term colloquial as a description of words because they said too many people don't understand what colloquial means, which is it's debatable whether that was a good idea or not, but. Colloquial does, in the lexicographic sense, it just means it's relating to conversation. So to say that something is used colloquially does not mean that it's slang, does not mean that it's improper, it just means that it's used in daily speech. And they felt that not enough people understood that distinction, so they stopped using that as a term. So it was called the Second War of the Dictionaries, and it's kind of hard for us today, unless we lived through it, or unless you've really read about it, to understand how agitated people became about this. It was an enormous kind of kerfluffle or tempest in a teacup. There's a wonderful book by a fellow named Herbert Morton, his last name Morton, called The Story of Webster's Third, and it's all about this kind of battle royale of the dictionaries. And all the public intellectuals who are really railing against this new dictionary, and it's much more entertaining than you would have any right to expect a book just about the history of a dictionary to be. It's a great slice of American kind of intellectual and educational history, and I recommend it highly to anybody. Mm.
What are your thoughts about online dictionaries?
Well, it depends. Yes, it's such a broad subject. I think it's a real move forward in many ways. For instance, I think it's delightful that the Merriam-Webster Company, they put their entire collegiate dictionary, they have the 11th collegiate dictionary online for free. That's great. They're a wonderful dictionary maker, and it's a great dictionary of the collegiate, and it's really, I think, spectacular that anybody can look at this dictionary for free. The Oxford English Dictionary, for instance, does not publish a dictionary for free, but you can get it at any library. And they have an amazing search engine that they've created for the dictionary. It's a really interesting new way of looking through a dictionary. I tried reading it online, and I couldn't. I just can't read that much on a computer. It gives me not just a headache, but a kind of a deep, abiding sense of ennui. It just doesn't work for me. I start to lose my focus on the world.
You can't make notes in the margin.
Right, you can't. And the page always looks the same, and dictionaries don't have that comfortable feel of a book and everything. But it is great for looking up words. The OED's search function on their dictionary is so much better than anybody else's that you're forced, even if you love books deeply as I do, you're still forced, I think, to say, okay, this is something new and interesting. This is a new and interesting and very useful way of looking at a book. For instance, if you go to their kind of advanced search page, you can look for any word anywhere in the dictionary. So it's not just if you want to look up cow, you just look up cow alphabetically. You can find the word cow anytime it's used in anywhere in 20,000, 30,000 pages of text. You can look up any author that they quote, and you can find instantly all the citations from, say, Maya Angelou or Jane Austen. And you can see all the times that she comes up in the dictionary. Mm. Most dictionaries are not that not comprehensive and thorough. So those, I think, are the really that's the good end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum, I'm slightly more dubious about. For instance, my understanding is that many people who are, say, younger and who have not grown up before dictionaries or before computers were really an everyday thing, many younger people just automatically use online dictionaries. And although it's wonderful that it's so accessible to them, I believe that many of the dictionaries they're using are they don't know anything about the dictionary. It's just, you know, that you can go to the dictionary on Yahoo, but we don't know who wrote the dictionary. Mm-hmm. We don't know what the sources were. It's hard to say this is unequivocally good. There are some wonderful aspects to it, but there are also some real, I think, potential problems with people just relying entirely on online dictionaries, because anybody can just say, yes, I have an online dictionary, and you have no basis for judging it, at least immediately.
Yeah. We've got to wrap up here. Maybe we could do one more word, and I would pick onomatomania.
Onomatomania. It's a vexation at being unable to think of the right word, which is something that's always been close to me. I've always enjoyed that. It does have some other meanings, which are not I didn't write about. It also means, in some circumstances, fear or dislike of a particular word. It is not an example of itself in that. I think it's a really wonderful word, and it is, of course, a word that I often have trouble thinking of.
Yeah, and at the end of the entry here for that word, you say, also see acnestis, which is a wonderful word.
Oh, yeah, they are very similar in a way. Acnestis is the spot on an animal's back that it cannot quite reach to scratch.
Yeah. We have the same difficulty as human beings.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Amin Shay, thank you very much for talking with us
this
afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Amin Shay is the author of Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 Pages. The book is now out in paperback from Perigee, which is a division of Penguin. It's 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from Chicago and Kansas City now. Here with those numbers, Todd Gleason.
Thanks so much, Celeste. On a Monday afternoon, futures finished in Chicago like this from the soft red winter wheat pit. Nearby contract today had a high price of $5.17, a low at $4.91 and a quarter, with a settlement price of $5.15 and three quarters. July wheat settled 24 cents higher on the afternoon. September futures followed suit. $5.44 and three quarters was the high for the day. The low at $5.17, settlement price at $5.42 and three quarters, up 24 on the afternoon. And the December contract in the wheat pit from Chicago, $5.70 and three quarters, the high, the low at $5.43 and three quarters, settlement price at $5.69, up 23 and three quarters. From Kansas City, nearby July futures, 23 and three quarters higher. The hard red settled at $5.63 and three quarters of a cent a bushel. From the corn pit, nearby July futures, up 13 and a half cents, but that was the big gainer in the pit for the day. The rest of them mixed, anywhere between three quarters lower in the far deferreds to about penny and a half higher in the December contract. July corn, though, a 13.5 cent gain. Nearby contract, a high of 360, a low at 339. Settlement price just a penny off the top at $3.59 a bushel. July corn settled 13.5 cents higher. September futures, 332 and a quarter, the high. Low at 320 and a half. Settlement price there at $3.31 and three quarters, up 3.5 in December contract. 339 and three quarters, the high. The low at 329 and a half. Settled 339 and a half, up 1 and 1 half. And the March futures, 352 and three quarters, the high. The low at $3.42 and a half. Settled at 352 and a half, up a penny and one quarter for the day. May futures at 362 and a quarter, high. Low at 353. Settlement price at 361 and a half, up 1. September, December, March, and May in the 2010 and 2011 contracts were either unchanged or down about 0.75 cents, just for an FYI. Oat futures, July contract 211, up 7 cents, and September 219, up 7. Now the soy complex, all red there for the day. July beans, a loss today. $11.40 the high, the low at 10.73 and three quarters. Settlement price in the July soybean futures, $10.91 and a half, down 36 and three quarters of a cent. August, 10.54 and three quarters the high, the low at $10.02. Settlement price, 10.18 and a half, down 26 and one quarter. And September futures, 9.82 and a half the high, the low at 9.43 and three quarters. Settlement price for the September beans at $9.55 and a half cents, down 16 and a quarter. November contract, the harvest month for the soybeans, $9.28 and a half the high, the low at 8.92. Settlement price at $9.11.5. November beans down 5.5. January futures, 9.36 the high, the low at $9.75, and settlement price at 9.19.5, down 6 on the afternoon. July soybean meal futures, 372.50 the high, the low at 353, settled 359.30, down $13. The August at 332.30, down 12.50. July soybean oil today, 33.20 the high, low at 32.47. Settled 33.27, up 57, and the August contract at 33.40 settlement price. August soybean oil futures up 56 cents on the afternoon. During the closing market report this afternoon, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. He serves as their senior grains analyst. And then later in the program, we'll hear from the folks at the Andersons about the cash grain market. They're located right here in Champaign County, Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
Todd.
And the livestock numbers on the day look like this for the afternoon. Futures like this. Nearby contract and the live cattle, 85.35 for the high, the low at 83.50. A settlement price at 84.77.5, up a buck 30 for the day. The October futures, a 90.45 top, bottom at 88.65. Settlement price at $90.25, up $1.60. In December futures, 90.42.5 the high, the low at 88.77.5, settlement price at $90.22.5, up a buck 32.5. And February live cattle, 89.85 the high, the low at 88.55, settlement price 89.67.5, 97.5 cents higher. August feeder cattle, 104.90 the high, the low at $103, settled 103.80, up 87.5. And September, 104.75 the high, the low at 103. Settlement price at 104.22.5, a dollar higher. October contract 104.85 in the feeder cattle for the high, the low at $103 even. Settled 104.30, a dollar 7.5 higher in the November futures, 75 cents the gain. 104.85 the high, the low at 103.40. Settlement price at $104.25 for 100 pounds. November feeder cattle up 75 cents. July futures, 59.80 the high, the low at 59.15. Settlement price at $59.50, 65 cents higher. August contract in the lean hogs, 54.65 the high, the low at 62.82.5. Settlement price at $63. They finished down 60 cents. In the October futures, a gain there, 59.55 the high, the low at 58.35. Settlement price for October lean hogs, 58.80, up 15 cents. December futures, a loss, 58.25 the high, the low at 57.10. December futures settled $57.15 in the lean hogs, down 80 cents. Frozen pork bellies, July futures, 62.50. The settlement price up 65 cents. And the August contract, 50 cents higher. They finished at $62.50. I'll return in just about 7 minutes.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. Henry Frayne is our technical director this afternoon. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. My name is Celeste Quinn. Coming up later today on The World from PRI, a singer from Cameroon found musical success in Paris. He saved his career and may be helping to save the language of his people, a Cameroonian in Paris. That story in the day's news coming up on The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock. The forecast for Illinois and Indiana is prepared by Mike Sola this afternoon, partly to mostly sunny, highs ranging from 76 in northeastern Indiana to 87.